This is the Daily Radio Ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel, Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the book of Psalms, chapters 137 through chapter 143.
Well, the Hebrews, they built a temple of gold and stone and splendor. They worshiped God inside this temple. But the Hebrews also wrote the Psalms, for they were not content to worship God in a temple. The Psalms seek to transform all of life into a temple. Their goal is to discover God in every circumstance, in every emotion of the soul. I like what Philip Yancey writes about the Psalms. He says, they contain the anguished journals of people who want to believe in a loving, gracious, faithful God while the world keeps falling apart around them. You know, Robert Frost once wrote of poets, he said, a poet has a lover's quarrel with the world. That's a great way to understand the Psalms. It's like a lover's quarrel with the world. It's a book of poems that lay bare the struggle between faith and life. The Psalms are poetry, and the goal of most poems isn't logic per se. It's more empathy and catharsis and feeling. Author Kathleen Norris, she comments, the Psalms do not theologize. One reason for this is that the Psalms are poetry, and poetry's function is not to explain, but to offer images and stories that resonate with our lives. This is what we find in the Psalms that we'll study tonight. The authors find themselves in a wide array of situations, but wherever they go, whatever they do, they find God in the middle of their mess. That's what the Psalms are all about. Well, in Psalm 137, the anonymous psalmist, he sings the blues. He's in Babylon, but not because he wants to be. You see, a few years earlier, the summer of 586 BC, to be exact, the Babylonians had sacked the city of Jerusalem, and they had taken the Jews to Babylon into exile as captives. It was in the ancient land of Babel, along the banks of the Euphrates River, that one of the Jews in lockup, one of these exiled Jews, he picked up his harp, and he started to play it like B.B. King and like Muddy Waters. He started singing the blues, and that's what we have in Psalm 137. He says, by the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down. During their captivity in Babylon, the Jews developed the habit of gathering by the riverside. You know, throughout their history, wherever Jews were displaced from their homeland, they would always gravitate toward or gather together by the river. I like that old hymn, "Shall We Gather at the River?" In Acts 16, verse 13, the Jews in Philippi, where do you find them? They've gathered by the riverside. Well, here they're by the river of Babylon. And he says, yea, we wept when we remembered Zion. Around 1,700 years earlier, God led Abraham and his family out of Babylon, out of the land of idols, to a land flowing with milk and honey. And yet once in that promised land, Abraham's descendants, they went back to the idols of Babylon. They fell into idolatry. And so what did God do? God sent them back to Babel, to the birthplace of idolatry. Sadly, sin reversed everything that God had done from the Jews. Now these Jews are sitting by the Euphrates. They're weeping over what was lost. In a sense, they're right back to where they started, because of their wayward hearts. You see, for centuries, the Jews had tried to have it both ways. Oh, they had benefited from the blessings of the land that God had given them. They had enjoyed the milk and the honey, but they had flirted with the pleasures of sin. It was as if the Jews had put honey on their forbidden fruit and tried to wash it down with a glass of milk. It doesn't mix. You can't have the milk and honey and the forbidden fruit at the same time. Jesus says it this way, no man can serve two masters. There comes a day when everyone decides, are you going to serve God or are you going to serve your idolatrous desires, your substitutes for God? I've heard it said, the human heart is an idol factory. And indeed it is. You see, man was made to worship. And once we reject God, we create all kinds of alternatives to try to satisfy that inclination. Sports teams or hobbies or careers or virtual worlds or drugs and alcohol. And yet to cure his people of idolatry, God sends them into the land of idolatry where they are allowed to taste the accompanying pain of the sins that they've committed. I like this quote. Life is full of splinters that we don't feel until we begin to slide backwards. Isn't that true? When the Hebrews backslid from God, they started to feel the splinters that you pick up from disobedience and from stubbornness. Now imagine a Jew. He's in Jerusalem. Every day he sees and he walks by this grand temple, this colossal temple. The place of worship, the worship of God, was the center of his national life. The worship of God dominated the skyline as well as his daily routine. Everything revolved around the temple. But now he's in Babylon. And now the cityscape, it's full of ziggurats, these astrological towers, these occult worship centers. He's surrounded by these idolatrous temples, horoscopes and the occult and soothsaying everywhere, demonic symbols on every corner. He feels defiled. This is a dark, dark place. The 70 years these Jews spent in Babylonian captivity caused them to miss the glory of God, the temple, the priests, the sacrifices, the feasts, the psalms. And so now, rather than sing hallelujah, he hangs up his harps. According to verse 2, we hung our harps upon the willows in the midst of it. Their reason to sing, their inspiration to play, had been snuffed out there in Babel. You know, sometimes you don't realize you're backsliding until you feel a few of those splinters. And the captivity woke up the Jews to the consequences of their sin. The Babylonian captivity was sort of a divine timeout that the Father had issued to his children. God reminded the Jews how much they missed him and his blessings. You know, it's been said we don't really love a thing until we realize it can be lost. It's interesting, the Jews who return from Babylon will never again be tempted with idolatry. They would sin in other ways, but not with idols. This Babylonian captivity was good medicine. It cured the Jews of their idolatry once and for all. Well, the psalmist continues in verse 3. He says, "For there, in Babylon, those who carried us away captive, they ask of us a song. And those who plundered us requested mirth, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion." You know, even today, the Hebrews are a musical people. They're renowned for their psalms and their singing and their dancing. Go to Israel with us. Go to Jerusalem and you'll see them dancing in the streets. And so their captors, they knew of this reputation, and so they wanted to be entertained. Sing us a song. Give us a dance. But how can you make merry when you have sinned in your heart? And you have let your God down. A song from the lips is disingenuous when there's an ache in your heart. And so the Jews answer their captors in verse 4. They say, "How shall we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? If I forget you, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget its skill. If I do not remember you, let my tongue cling to the roof of my mouth. If I do not exalt Jerusalem above my chief joy." I like what commentator William Heslop summed up Psalm 139. He said, "Wickedness is always followed by weeping." And indeed it is. God's presence was the psalmist's chief joy. And he would rather have his tongue cling to the roof of his mouth than to feign joy or to fake celebration. He'd rather gargle with super glue than live his life apart from God and fake the joy and celebration that should exist in his heart. Verse 7, "Remember, O Lord, against the sons of Edom, the day of Jerusalem, who said, raz it to its very foundation." You know, Jerusalem was sacked on my wife's birthday, by the way. I always remember it. July the 18th, 586. Now, she wasn't born in 586 BC. She was born on July 18th. But But Jerusalem was sacked July 18th, 586 BC. And the invaders proved to be savages. You got to understand, the Babylonians, they burned the city to the ground. They raped the Jewish women. They threw their children from the windows so that their heads would burst on the streets. And they laughed while doing it. And all the while, God's people were suffering these atrocities from the Babylonians, the Edomites, their neighbors to the south. They were cheering on the Babylonians. Oh, razz it, ravage it, tear it to the ground. And here the psalmist prays for God to judge these callous Edomites. He says, "O daughter of Babylon, who are to be destroyed, happy the one who repays you as you have served us. Happy is the one who takes and dashes your little ones against the rock." The psalmist is seeking retribution. Understand, this is a man who lives under the law. All he knows is an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And so he asks God to return the brutality of the Babylonians on their own heads. Now, as Christians, we've been lifted to a higher standard, because we've become privy to God's mercy, to God's grace. We were once enemies of God, yet he chose to forgive us and to show us love. Therefore, he asks us to show that same love and mercy on our enemies. The psalmist, though, he lived under these laws of retribution, the eye for the eye, the tooth for the tooth. And here he asks God to bring about justice, to bring about fairness. He wants to see the same crimes done against the Babylonians that they had done to the Jewish people. Here's another thought before we judge this psalmist and his cry for retribution. Not only does this psalmist know only justice, we shouldn't minimize what he endured, especially from our vantage point so far away and so long ago. Put yourself in Jewish shoes for a moment. Imagine yourself in that ravaged city, under that assault, in that siege. One author writes this: "Those who find fault with the psalmist are those who have never seen their temple burned, their city ruined, their wives ravished, and their children's head dashed against the rocks. They might not be so velvet-mouthed if they had suffered in this fashion." I'm not sure any of us knows exactly how we would have reacted under these kinds of circumstances. I don't think we would know until we were put in that situation. Well, Psalm 138. "I will praise you with my whole heart. Before the gods, I will sing praises to you. I will worship toward your holy temple and praise your name for your loving kindness and your truth." Notice here, David praises God for his loving kindness and truth. Loving kindness is the Old Testament term for grace. In the New Testament, John 1 verse 17, we're told the law was given through Moses, but grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. David lived under the law, but he seems to have had a new covenant mindset. He certainly enjoyed new covenant blessings. He trusted in love that he hadn't earned and didn't deserve. He trusted in God's grace. Here he thanks God, he praises him for his loving kindness and his truth, or his grace and his truth. I think David was a man ahead of his time. I guess you could say he had a Renaissance faith. And pay attention to the incredible statement that David makes next in verse 2. He says, "For you, God, have magnified your word above all your name." If you want to know why we put so much value upon God's word, it's because God exalts his word. He has exalted his word even above his name. Now, to the Hebrews, nothing was more significant than the name of God. Go back. The third commandment prohibited taking the name of God in vain. In Leviticus 24, you read about a man who was stoned to death for blaspheming God's name. Later in their history, the Jews so revered the name of the Lord that they became afraid to even pronounce his name. It came to a point where the Jews refused to even write God's full name, so they would only write the consonants. Today we've lost the Hebrew name for God. It's simply written YHWH. The Tetragrammaton is what it's called. The vowels for another of God's names, Lord or Adonai, are transposed into those consonants, which creates the name Yahweh that we often associate with God. But the real name for God has been lost to history. Here's the point. Only one item was more revered, more highly sought after by the Jews than God's name. It was holy to them. There was only one thing higher, and that was His Word. This book you hold in your hand tonight. As David tells us in verse 2, God has magnified His Word even above His name. And if God has exalted His Word so supremely, let us never be guilty of neglecting it. Taking heed to the Scriptures should be our top priority. Several years ago I received a letter from a church member. It was one of those encouraging notes that a pastor, he keeps and he puts it where he can find it and he pulls it out on real difficult days and he reads it again over and over. And it said a lot of nice things, but here's one line from the letter. It said, "Thank you for teaching God's Word and not a lot of other stuff." Thank you for writing that note. There's a quote in Haley's Bible Handbook I agree with wholeheartedly. It reads, "A church that does not enthrone the Bible in the lives of its people is false to its mission." If God magnifies His Word above His name, then how can we possibly esteem it too highly? Well, verse 3 continues, "In the day when I cried out, you answered me and made me bold with strength in my soul. All the kings of the earth shall praise you, O Lord, when they hear the words of your mouth. Yes, they shall sing of the ways of the Lord, for great is the glory of the Lord. Though the Lord is on high, yet He regards the lowly, but the proud He knows from afar." Notice it doesn't matter your race or your gender or your economic status or your education, even your football affiliation. God will still listen to your prayer. The only exception, the only person God won't hear, is the proud person. Which, coming back around to the football affiliation, might pose some problems for those Florida Gator fans because they've become real proud over these past years. But only God knows the heart. He says, "Though I walk in the midst of trouble, you will revive me. You will stretch out your hand against the wrath of my enemies, and your right hand will save me. The Lord will perfect that which concerns me." Here's the reason God allows us to walk in the midst of trouble. It's because the Lord is perfecting us. You really need to understand this. He is not just protecting us, He is perfecting us. You see, a muscle gets stronger only when it's met with resistance. And the same is true with a faith that never encounters opposition or difficulty, never develops. It never becomes stronger. And if you're a parent, you need to pay special attention to this verse. Remember, God's goal is not just protecting us, but perfecting us. As parents, we need to take a cue here from the model parent, God. For there are too many Christian parents today that are so afraid of this world and its temptations that their top priority for their children is their protection. You need to understand that is not God's top goal for your kids. God desires their perfection, not just their protection. You see, parents today, they want to keep their kids in their little Christian bubble, insulated from any trials or any tests or any temptations. They homeschool their kids. They play baseball in the church league. They can't even run in the neighborhood. Hey, as a matter of fact, we've met parents who are so overly protective, they're afraid to let their kid attend a youth function or a church retreat. Hey, such a parent may be protecting their child, but they are definitely not perfecting their child. Parents, you've got to let your children feel the stress of the storm. Not all the time. Not without monitoring their progress. Not without open lines of communication. But you've got to let them experience some outside stress or they'll never sink deeper roots. And it's good to let them experience that stress while you're still there, while they're in your home, where you can help them deal with those problems and sort through those issues in a godly and in a biblical way. We've got to understand that our goal as parents is not just to protect our kids. God's goal for them is to perfect them in their faith. Well, he closes this psalm. Your mercy, O Lord, endures forever. Do not forsake the works of your hands. In other words, Lord, keep up the good work. Psalm 139 is a favorite psalm. If the Billboard Top 40 had been around at the time, Psalm 139 would have stayed at number one for many, many weeks. Of all the psalms, Psalm 139 possesses some of the deepest devotion. It's probably the psalmist's most beautiful ballad. It speaks of God's omniscience, his all-knowing, his omnipresent. He's everywhere at once. His omnipotence, his all-powerfulness, his almightiness. One author pens, "Language utterly fails me in the exposition of this psalm." The psalm begins, "O Lord, you have searched me and known me." This Hebrew word that gets translated search, it means to pierce through, to see through. You know, you'll hear someone say, "Wow, I can see, that guy can see right through me." Or my wife, boy, she's perceptive. She can just see right through me. That's the sense here. He's saying to God, "God, just see through me. Lay bare my motives. Understand my heart." You know, the Greek philosophers, they used to say, "Know thyself." To the Greeks, the key to enlightenment was introspection, was to turn inward, was to focus on yourself. In fact, this is the assumption of modern psychology as well. And yet, here's the problem. I'm destined for confusion if my goal is to know myself. Hey, I might as well face it. I'm a bundle of contradictions. Not all my motivations are pure, even on good days. Feelings and flirtations, they come and go. I'm a bundle of emotions and thoughts. You see, real wisdom is not trying to understand myself. It's knowing God. And it's knowing that God has me pegged, that God understands me. And it's asking him to search me out, to see through me, to lay bare my motives, to come humbly before him, and to let him sort out my inner life. And if I ask him to do that, he will. "Oh Lord, you have searched me and known me. You know my sitting down and my rising up. You understand my thought afar off. You comprehend my path and my lying down and are acquainted with all my ways." That's a pretty comprehensive knowledge. God has made a study of you. He knows you inside and out. He understands your movements and your motives and your meditations and your manners. In short, God knows all there is to know about you. "For there is not a word on my tongue, but behold, O Lord, you know it altogether." I mean, have you ever had that word on the tip of your tongue and yet you couldn't conjure it up when you needed it? God knew what it was. If you'd asked him, he'd have probably told you. "You have hedged me behind and before and laid your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high. I cannot attain it." I mean, it's such a good feeling to know that someone is that in tune with me and empathizes so deeply with my struggles, that God really knows me. Isn't it a wonderful feeling to know that you're known? To know that there's someone who understands. Or someone who knows you inside and out and still loves you, that's encouraging. You can be sure that no one will ever know you nor love you as much as God does. Verse 7, "Where can I go from your spirit? Or where can I flee from your presence? If I ascended into heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in hell, behold, you are there." He's Lord over heaven and Lord over hell. Sometimes we think that the devil and his demons are running hell. Not so. God is Lord over all things.
Every emotion you can think of is found in the book of Psalms. From exuberant praise to devastating despair and everything in between. The authors of these beautiful songs poured their hearts out to God. They sang because of sorrow and because of gratitude in the middle of terror and at the end of trials. Their words are recorded to aid our own expressions of emotion and remind us to ultimately turn to God, no matter the circumstances. We're glad you tuned in today to Sandy Adams Radio to join us in this examination of the Book of Psalms. We'd love to hear how God has been using His Word in your own life. So please take a moment to connect with us. You can call us at 770-736-2828. Again, that's 770-736-2828. If you want to hear today's teaching again or perhaps share it with someone you feel needs to hear it, let us know when you call. Just mention today's date and we'll send you a CD with the message in its entirety. We've also archived many of Pastor Sandy's messages at sandyadams.org. Just click on Sermons in the menu or scroll down the page to find a list of all the books of the Bible Pastor Sandy has shared messages from. You can even read Pastor Sandy's teaching notes. That's all for today, but join us next time for another edition of Sandy Adams Radio.